episode 19 of season 17 of GeekSpeak. One login collapses playground exit. I'm Lyle Troxell. With me from my new home in Boulder Creek, California, in the Santa Cruz Mountains, is Mr. Miles Elam, a software engineer, pedant, curmudgeon, and political junkie. Hi, Miles.
How's it going?
Quite well, thank you. We also have Mr. Brian Young. It's been a while. He's an iOS developer, a designer, and software conference producer. Hey, Brian.
Hey, welcome to the town, Lyle.
Thank you. That's right. I'm in your town now.
Yeah, I had to drive all the way from the north end of town to the south end of town.
It's a long drive.
Yeah, I almost held up the show doing that.
You're not doing WWDC this year, but I'm going to be there. And I'm planning on being there every day. And you and I are going to a couple things together. And we're recording from downtown San Jose from the conference. So it should be an interesting GeekSpeak week for us.
Yeah. No, I won't be in the conference, but there's a lot of events going on around it, and so, I will be around.
Yeah. So I'll be tweeting off of Lyle on Twitter, and you'll be using...
Brian Cordan Young.
And then Miles won't be at WWC or even over the hill, but if you want to hear about goats and chickens and things like that, you can follow him. He's Miles Elam on Twitter.
Actually, I don't talk about the goats on Twitter.
No? You talk about tech on Twitter.
Yeah.
Let's talk about breaches of one login.
This is a password manager. This allows you to not use the same password on every site, which you shouldn't be using, and also generates a password that you really wouldn't think of on your own. Unfortunately, the security is only as good as the service that is providing it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, one login has been breached.
Ugh.
And they had access to customer data and the ability to decrypt that data.
So their service was not a trust no one. They could unencrypt your passwords and data.
Mm-hmm.
So different than some of the other password managers. I use 1Password, which is different than 1Login. And 1Password, specifically with the way I have it set up, I'm not trusting anybody else. I know my password. It encrypts it, the entire bundle into that password. And then I share it on my own services. So no one else has access to it.
Right. The trade-off being that if you ever lose access to that or forget your password, then it's gone.
It's gone.
Right.
All of the sites that you have are gone.
Inherent is you're taking responsibility that you've got control of this, but nobody else can have control of it.
Yeah. And the convenience of something like 1Login is really great because you can go to a hotel lobby, go on in, you know, you're using somebody else's computer completely, log into your 1Login account, and then log into any site you want. And all you have to do is remember 1Password, which is way convenient. Of course, that hotel lobby keyboard probably has a keylogger on it. So now you've lost your master password. Not so good. That's a bummer. What are they doing to alleviate the issue?
Well, as it stands right now, they've just sent out notifications to all their customers. It's pretty early on in there. I don't know what you can do at that point. Even if you find the perpetrators, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're safe. So once a breach occurs, it's kind of like the door's open. They've gone through your papers, your effects. And so you know that they have it. It's a question of what are they going to do with it.
Yeah.
So just to be clear, they have the passwords in the clear, unencrypted?
They weren't in the clear, but they did have the means to decrypt it.
Mm-hmm. So the truth is that if you're a 1Login customer, what you need to do is go change all your passwords to all your sites and probably switch services, I would assume. That's a bummer.
Have you looked at how many passwords you have at this point?
In 1Password? I'm assuming hundreds. I have no idea. I'll launch the app right now.
For something, when you're dealing with security, it's so much worse, especially when you put all of your trust into one service. And this is one that is based on the cloud. It's just out there. And when it gets breached, you've lost the whole kit and caboodle. It's a single point of failure.
So my 1Password database has 771 items in it. And that's a lot. And I have to say the one thing I love about this new laptop, Mac laptop, is the keyboard fingerprint. So for me to unlock my 1Password app, because I've got my fingerprint, I was able to just click the button with my finger, which is nice. Not having
once or twice or three times, and then it goes in.
It definitely is not stable and reliable. I wouldn't recommend people buying this thing, but I do love every time the keyboard feature works and dislove it every time it doesn't work. I have to say, though, that... Yeah, other than that, it's not. I wouldn't recommend getting the touch bar MacBook. It's just not.
Well, you don't have a choice if you get the 15-inch.
Yeah, if you get a brand new one.
This is something we were discussing before the show. How much I'm really disappointed with Apple and their offerings. I find them to be so... Having them as a single point, you buy them and they just work, is great. But they are so locked down now as compared to what they used to be, that they just feel restrictive to me now. I feel like as soon as I would buy a new laptop or a new phone from Apple, then the clock is already ticking for when it becomes obsolete, and I would have to shell out a whole bunch of more money to get that.
That's true. Brian, do tell me why few people are majoring in computer science.
This was not a professional study or a professional write-up, but somebody in his spare time started looking into this question of why they're, the number of CS students has been so stable or so few in compared to other fields.
Yeah.
So anemic compared to other fields. Now, there's a couple interesting things about this write-up. First of all, most of the write-up was based on a faulty assumption. So he started looking at data that was at the peak of the last great maximum point at which CS graduates were coming out of school.
Mm-hmm.
And this was around 2005. And later, when he published this and sent it out to Twitter and friends and Hacker News and everything, lots of people started poking holes in his ideas. And he later got data that goes back to 1975. And in that, you can see very clearly that there's these two great big peaks. And in between 1984, when the last great peak, and 2005, it remained pretty constant at about... Let's see if I can see in the graph. A little bit below 25,000 graduates a year in computer science. And then we hit the late 90s, and it shoots up to 2005, where we got right into about 60,000 CS graduates before it plummets back down into the 40,000s.
Mm-hmm.
So with this new information, you start realizing, wow, the greatest influence on the number of CS graduates seems to be these large events that happen. So what would you say was...
In 84?
Yeah, what would you say that would be?
I don't know.
The introduction of Microsoft DOS?
The introduction of the IBM PC four years earlier.
Right, okay. 4 years earlier, and so people are in high school learning the PC, and then they go to college, they decide to major in it.
Exactly. And then they come out of college, and there is this, well, of course, there's a lag to going into college and choosing that as your major. And then there's this glut of CS graduates looking for jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And since so many people are having a hard time finding jobs, it plummets. At least that is the ultimate conclusion that he came to.
You know, it's interesting. The three of us sit together, and none of us have computer science degrees. And yet we're all computer science engineers, right?
Yeah. Well, and that...
Well, computer... When you say computer science engineers, that's a misnomer. Computer scientist versus computer engineer.
What I'm saying is that what I'm assuming the statistics are, this write-up is about people working in programming. They're leaving school and doing programming. Did he include the other tracks that are not computer science, or is it just computer science? Most of the times, computer science actually gives you a programming degree... a programming career.
A programming career, yes. But he was initially comparing this to other engineering fields and how the number of graduates had increased and did not show the same trough and the static state for a while. In his initial data, he was trying to figure out the reasons. And he went through a whole bunch of them, including that you don't need to be a computer scientist to become a programmer. In fact, we'd argue pretty heavily that a lot of computer science doesn't apply to making apps.
Yeah.
But
then you have a lot of famous case studies in the industry that we kind of look up to, of people that decide to drop out of school and do their own company.
Exactly. So obviously Bill Gates is not among the graduates of CS.
I'm sure he has a few honorary degrees at this point.
Quite a few.
So what's the reason is that people jump into this field when interesting events occur?
Yeah, so the other great peak is in 2005. And between the 83 peak and the 2005 peak, there was a good 5 or 6 years that it all hovered around that 25,000 mark.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, 2005 was 4 years after the dot-com crash.
So why would that cause a boost?
Well, everybody was excited about the internet in the late 90s, and that's where all the CS graduates come from. But it's when the news of people not being able to get into a profession after they graduate, which sends the people signing up for a CS degree plummeting.
Right, got it. And then recovers at that point.
And we are on the way up at the moment. At the moment, it is shooting up and has just passed the 2005 mark. So we now have more CS graduates coming out of school than we ever have before.
That's very cool. Welcome, everyone. Let's get some space news going on, Miles.
We have always thought that a star has a certain life cycle when they're of a given size. In other words, 25 times as massive as our star, the sun, soul, that it, you know, burns its hydrogen and helium at its core, and then after that's all used up, it goes into the heavier elements, into your oxygen, stuff like that, and it balloons out to a red giant, and then after all of that has been exhausted, it can no longer sustain the fusion. Everything starts to collapse in. You get a massive shockwave, supernova, type 2 supernova.
And neutron and, star.
Right. And if they get big enough, they go back to a black hole. It just continues to contract.
But different stars' sizes will degrade and change over time differently. Like, I don't think ours is ever going to go to a neutron star, right? Just going to blow
balloon out. It will be a white dwarf.
Okay.
Right, it'll puff up before it finally collapses down to a much cooler, smaller star.
Right, a cinder, but it won't be large enough to be able to
supernova
make the electrons fuse into the protons, make a degenerate matter of just a neutron ball. Which,
by the way, a neutron star is the roundest object that we know of.
Not only that, really nice thing to tweak your brain, a neutron star is a single large atom.
Ooh, cool. No, I didn't know that. Are you sure?
It's just a bunch of neutrons.
Yeah, but...
And there is no distinction between them. It's a single mass.
Hmm, interesting. Were you going to say anything else about this? What else
yes.
do we know about
so
stars?
What they found something very unusual, astronomers, I should say. When they were looking through NASA's Hubble and Spitzer space telescopes for a star that was getting brighter, it seemed to be going through those changes, 25 times as massive as our sun. And then instead of exploding in a huge ball of glory, you know, the supernova, the type 2 supernova, it just disappeared.
What?
As I say, it went out with a whimper instead of a bang.
It fell into its own black hole?
So, yes, apparently it skipped the supernova explosion and went straight from collapsing star to
black hole.
Yeah.
Well, how do we know star? It just didn't go non-nuclear? How do we know it just didn't? It just stopped radiating and just became a dead body. Like what?
How do it you, was too large for that.
Too much mass.
Right.
Interesting.
So with that much, with at 25 times the mass of our sun, if all of it comes down together, you have more than what a neutron star has, because when you have a star it's that large, you end up, the supernova sends off the material to make a planetary nebula. And then you just have that core left, and that's enough material to have it be a neutron star. But if you had all that material that later forms the planetary nebula after the supernova.
If it all collapses originally?
Yeah, if that all comes together, then you still have enough mass to go straight to. Then you still have enough mass to make a black hole.
To make an event horizon.
Even though the original star was not the type of candidate you would expect to make a black hole.
That's interesting. So different cycles are going to happen.
So have physicists theorized this before, or does this bring in new possible physics?
They had theorized it. This is something that, because there are a lot of hypotheses rolling around. Possibilities. And so to see something in action, they go, oh, this is something new. And this can explain the possibility of black holes of a certain mass that they weren't, that they didn't really have a model for before.
Is this one just that particularly massive, or is it sort of at the low end of?
Well, that's the thing, that you, when you have a black hole, you can have the supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies, for example. They're just massive,
yeah,
massive gross eaters. Then you have the type that are, you know, following the supernova explosion, it has just enough mass to be able to, you know, break that, the San Jessica limit, go to a black hole, collapse to a singularity. But this one is more mass from that star than you would, anyway. Yeah.
That's really
cool. You get it.
Since we're doing space news, I'll just let you know that LIGO did it again. The third black hole merger was detected with using gravity waves detections. Mm-hmm. So we just got that again. It means that they're not that uncommon. The thing that's interesting is that two black holes orbiting each other and collapsing into each other, which is what we've been detecting mm-hmm. and talking about, wasn't the assumed first sources of gravitational waves. We didn't think that was what was going to happen. We're seeing them more than we expected, and they're relatively hard to detect these types of objects without gravitational waves. So it could be a candidate for dark matter. Dark matter.
So the more common candidate they were expecting was what, an existing companion star falling into a black hole?
I think that was what the idea was, that just black holes consuming things in general. So two orbital black holes is a little interesting, because how do they form and how do they come together? And one of the theories is that because of the commonality of these things, they seem to be more common than we expect, mm-hmm. in the sense that we've detected three of them in the last few years. I can't recall when the first LIGO detection was, that it's possible these are after effects, that black holes are actually after effects of the Big Bang, as in they were not formed in the ways that we were thinking they were formed, that they've been around for a long time, and that they're more common in the universe, and that could be why they look like there's so much more mass. There could be a lot more of these than we thought.
Which is odd, because gravity distorts light. You would think you'd be able to see that lensing effect, which from what I understand, we haven't. We see the effect of the gravity, but not of any of the other things that we'd expect from massive objects.
So the gravitational waves created by the new black hole collision had traveled across 3 billion years before they got to us. So they are old. Not as old as the universe, of course, but that is quite old.
Now, there is something else I want to talk about with regard to those black holes mm-hmm. merging. As a point of reference, when you have a supernova go off, that is more light from that one star in that relatively short period of time than the entire rest of the galaxy.
Wait, when what happens?
When a supernova.
When a star goes
supernova, that is more light than the rest of the galaxy's stars put together.
Wow.
In terms of output for a very short period of time. This merger of black holes, when I was looking at Phil Plait, the bad astronomer, watching his feed, the pair of merging black holes 3 billion light years away has nearly outshone the rest of the universe.
That's amazing. Wait.
For a short period of time.
It doubled the light output of the universe?
Very nearly.
It's a lot of light. So detecting a black hole, as you said, if you see other light sources and it mutates that other light source, then you can see it. But the trouble with these black holes that have been around for a long time mm-hmm. is they rarely have other light sources around them because they consume things. And so it's one way of thinking of it.
Yeah.
The other way to think about it is that, in any case, so it's a free-floating black hole somewhere out in space is not easy to detect because you have to have it go in front of some other faraway thing or have light around it. And therefore, it is a really good candidate for dark matter, which is pretty cool because I love that we didn't expect necessarily to find what we'd find by getting LIGO to turn on and detect these things and seeing these so repeatedly are really reshaping what we think about the universe. It's pretty cool. Let's go ahead and go into a little bit of travel.
Well, we were talking about password managers earlier, mm-hmm. and the password manager you and I use is 1Password, and they've released a new feature, which is kind of interesting to me, though I don't know if it really solves the problem. So here's the idea. The idea is that when you're traveling across a border, especially with the laws of the United States, Border Patrol, Border Police, the TSA, or the customs agents, have the right to look at your phone. In fact, we covered a story not long ago where that right is within 100 miles of the border. Yep. So
which
encompasses a like vast quantity of population of the United States.
Yeah, far more than half, the vast majority of the population of the U.S.
Right. And politics as they are these days, many people have become concerned about their devices getting out of their control. So 1Password released a feature where if you are part of their subscription service, you can mark particular password vaults as being travel vaults. And when you turn on travel mode, which is undetectable on the device, when you turn on travel mode, those vaults will be removed from the device. So any passwords that are sensitive, maybe some of Netflix passwords for you, Lyle, any other highly sensitive banking information you might put in one of these travel vaults. And when you're about to go through customs, the idea is you turn on travel mode and these vaults are deleted. And so there you go.
From your device.
From your device. So if you lose control of your device, it goes in the hands of the border agents. Maybe they have one of these many exploit kits that they use to...
Or they ask you to unlock your phone. And you go, okay, because I don't want to be arrested.
Right.
Do it.
Maybe you don't want to go through the 5 hours of standing up for your rights and waiting in a poorly lit room. Anyways, so there's no way they can get the passwords that are important there. The funny thing to me, though, and the thing that I think... is totally missed in this is if I lose control of my phone by a border agent, I'm not worried about what they find on the phone. I'm worried about what they put on the phone because it's far more damaging and far more invasive for any sort
for them to continue surveillance on your system.
Exactly.
Well, I don't understand something. I then, after I've done traveling, turn travel mode back off and they come and they get downloaded again.
Right.
Why wouldn't the border agent do that?
Because you can't detect by looking at the phone whether you are on travel mode or not. Now, the border agent could look and see like, well, you really only have a couple passwords on here and they don't seem terribly important.
If you can turn it back on, off, then the border agent can turn it back off. Or is it a timed thing?
So I was trying to find this out. Okay. I think it's done through the website. Now this is their subscription service, which has to use their site.
It's an option when you're using 1Password to have your own vault and you manage it yourself, or you have them manage it. And when you have them manage it, I'm not sure about the password, the trust no one aspect, whether they have to know your root password or not to do this. I don't think they do, but I'm not really sure.
No, I don't believe they do either. Of course, you and I, we use Dropbox to sync them. We could just stop syncing.
I don't use Dropbox to sync them.
Actually. Oh, you don't?
Oh, wait. Oh, yeah. I do Dropbox for syncing for that one.
Right.
For my personal management software, I use WebDAV, my own server, but not my password file because it's Dropbox is a lot easier on iOS devices to handle.
Yeah. So there's plenty of companies that they issue devices to their employees that if they're going out of the country, they have sensitive enough information that if they lose control of their device, they say, don't bring it back. They don't.
When we travel for Netflix at certain areas, we're suggested to bring temporary devices, so laptops and phones. And that way, when we get back, we just deliver them back to the tech department and they erase them.
Kind of that's a moot point with the recent changes that have been proposed for telling people they can't travel with laptops anyway.
At all.
Yeah, if you're definitely. Going internationally. Yeah.
I was thinking with that story, Brian, about a general idea would be to actually have two different operating systems on your phone and have it partitioned and actually let the operating system boot into one mode or another mode, and it's to by your choice with some trick or some secret. And that would be like a really great way to handle it, right? Where it looks like a completely simple phone with nothing on it except for the base operating system.
Which is a great idea as long as nobody else does it.
Well, it could be done with, you know, a complicated process and then locked down for, you know, 50 hours where it only looks like that for 50 hours. Of course, it makes more sense just to have a separate phone. Let's move on, shall we? Let's get a little more space news. I was getting kind of excited about that.
Yes. Well, you have the Parker Solar Probe.
What is
soon
that?
Soon to leave the Earth and examine the one major body that we haven't really taken a close look at yet.
The Sun?
The Sun. It was named for a astrophysicist professor, Eugene Parker. He predicted the existence of high-speed solar winds. And the reason why we're going out there was we really don't know all that much about it.
It's so funny. I don't think the sun is going out there. I think the sun is going in there. I'm a very solar, you know, helix-centric.
Heliocentric, yeah.
Heliocentric person, I think.
Now, this has been apparently on NASA's bucket list for 60 years to be able to do this. The sun, I mean, is not particularly close. But then again, we have...
Nine light minutes, I think.
Yes, but we do have the outer planets we've gone to. And
those are a lot farther away.
They are. At the same time, people are wondering, like, well, is this just going to plunge into the sun? No, it's actually going to take several flybys. But it's, if you imagine, and this is the example that was given, that the Earth and the sun are a meter apart.
Okay, this is not really true, but go on.
No, if to scale, like okay, if you made that scale, then the probe that they're sending out would be something on the order of 3 centimeters.
From the sun?
From the sun.
It's getting a lot closer.
And when you're talking about this, when we say that like, there's a lot we don't know about the sun, we don't know really why the corona is hotter than the surface of the sun.
We still don't know that? That's so awesome.
There's some thoughts about it, but you have to actually go there and take the measurements and get some information.
Is the corona the white radiant? It must be if it's hotter, so, yeah.
I mean, the whole thing is white.
Well, I mean, I just say that it's the temperature denotes, with black body radiation, the temperature denotes the color. And so, is below the corona not as white? Is it more, you know, not as...
In the human visible spectrum, it's all white.
It's all white. It's all bright white.
Right. Okay. Funny side note, you think, wait, isn't the sun yellow? No, it's really not.
No, it's white. The corona...
Well, the thing is, the corona is up to 300 times hotter. It's not just a little bit hotter.
It's 300
times hotter than the surface.
And when you say surface, what do you mean? How far away is the corona from the surface? And how do you define the surface based off from the corona? I guess this is why we're sending the probe. Right? I know we know a lot more about this than our general knowledge, but that's cool. So it's going to fly 3 centimeters close to the sun.
It's going to come within 6.5 million kilometers from the sun's surface.
Oh, very cool.
Now, the thing is, how do you get that close without burning up?
Move really fast? No.
It needs a heat shield. In this case, it's 2.3 meters wide, 11 centimeters thick, made up of a special carbon foam sandwiched between two thin sheets. So even though the outside shield will come to be somewhere around 1400 C.
That's hot.
The instruments inside will stay at room temperature, presumably a relatively warm room, but room
That's
temperature.
That's really cool. So it's a big foam shield.
Right, and it'll make its pass, and then as it goes out to a wider elliptical orbit, going out to the orbit of Venus, for example, mm-hmm. and the orbit of Earth again, presumably it'll be shedding that heat through all that time, so it makes another pass.
So if it has to shield itself by putting this big, you know, foot-thick foam insulating thing, how is it going to take pictures and get probes and such? I mean,
you don't want to send a picture directly looking at the sun anyway. You're not going to get any information. But you can get information about the peripheral stuff that's around you, the composition of the gas that's around you, the luminosity that's there.
It's going to be awesome. What's the timeline?
It'll come closest to the sun for the first time, December 19th, 2024. Oh, I'm sorry. No. The first time will be November 1st, 2018. But the closest one will be December 19th, 2024.
And after that, all the other dates are before 2019. Because as we know from Star Trek IV, when you slingshot around the sun, you go back in time.
Oh, definitely. That's totally true.
It'll be launching in July, late July of 2018.
This is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell, and I'm speaking with Brian Young and Miles Elam. We're talking about technology. I think it's your turn, Brian. I think we're going to talk about Apple's Swift Playgrounds.
As a starter for Apple's big developer week with all of their news announcements, they were whetting people's appetite with a little news about their iPad app, the Swift Playgrounds.
Which I've played with. It's cool.
Yeah, you played with it. We've had some requests actually to kind of cover it more in depth. And I got to say that I have hesitated doing that because not because I don't think it's really cool, but because Swift Playgrounds on an iPad, I write Swift just about every day on a Mac, and trying to sit down and doing this on the iPad has just been a little frustrating for me.
Do you have a keyboard for your iPad?
And that's the thing. I think that's the trick. I don't have a keyboard, but I do sometimes use my Mac keyboard to act as a keyboard. It's kind of funny sitting there typing on my iPad from my Mac. Breaks a few rules.
Yeah.
So what Apple's released now is that they're going to allow or open up with the next version of Swift Playgrounds coming out next week, all of these hooks into various hardware. All these...
like robots?
All these robots. All these toy robots. We've got Lego Mindstorm. You've got the Parrot drones. You've got...
You're serious about robots?
Oh, yeah. Totally serious. And so Sphero is another one that people know a lot. That's the BB-8
robot. When you say they're going to open it up, meaning they're going to add libraries to the Swift Playgrounds app that allow you to connect to those devices?
Yes. It doesn't say explicitly how it's done, what kind of library it is.
I'm sure I'll learn about it next week at WWDC.
Exactly. But what is clear is that any Bluetooth robot device should be able to be connected to it. So the Lego Mindstorms go back to 2013. These don't have to be devices that are coming out made specifically for it.
Cool.
Yeah. So I've had a couple robot toys with my kids, mm-hmm. and what's always frustrated me is that they are sort of glorified. What was the old programming language? The Logo programming language. They're sort of like glorified instructions to make something just move around.
Right.
I'm trying to find one of the ones, like maybe Lego Mindstorm has this, where you have enough sensors that you can actually react and respond to the world.
Yeah, I mean, Lego Mindstorm's had that for a while. Things like, if this probe gets hit, turn to your left, and if this probe gets hit, turn to your right, and in general, go forward. So that kind of does a self-navigating robot. But it's pretty minimal. It's not like you're doing a whole AI-type thing. But if you're running an app on, I don't know, I'm wondering how much it will be a toy versus a useful thing. I program all the time as well for iOS devices and such, and I don't use an iPad or iPhone to program. I use Xcode on a Mac. I can't imagine being highly functional on it. For a learning experience, I think Swift Playgrounds is wonderful. And if you're curious about programming, you have an iPad, definitely download Swift Playgrounds because they can, from a total beginning standpoint, they can walk you through and teach you how to program.
So the promise of it is there are these... Swift Playground books that are written. And the idea is there's a part of that code that you can customize and rewrite yourself, but there's a bunch of other code that's hidden from you that just is setting up the environment so that you can do what that lesson is supposed to be about.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like programming in a little sandbox. I mean, that's the whole idea.
When I was teaching programming at UCSC, it was constantly surprising to me that the first 4 hours of starting to program is getting the people's computers to be available for programming.
Right.
You know, teach them how to use the terminal, teach them to add a text editor that doesn't modify the text by adding smart quotes and making sure they understand how to upload to FTP and what a web server is. And like this process of doing most the development I was comfortable with, which is web development, takes a long time of setup. And having something that just out of the box is an app that works and right away you're programming removes all that pain and makes it fun.
So I'm kind of fascinated with this idea that there are so many people that have taken a crack at trying to make programming easier. This is obviously focused on the elementary and high school set because that's how simplified they've been able to make the environment. And yet the language is designed to be something that can write large-scale apps and potentially even operating systems in the future, though it's not there yet. There's been all these other experiments with things like Scratch, which is a graphic environment where you're moving these blocks around to create your program. I don't know. Is this the next great phase of opening up computers and programming to the masses, or is this just yet another attempt to just get into the schools and make sure that every student is going to be using Swift in the future instead of JavaScript?
Yeah, good question. I've been looking more at server-side JavaScript stuff just for fun. I'm sorry, server-side Swift stuff just for fun. I, I used to have this optimistic perspective that everybody could learn to program and be amazingly productive in developing. And I thought it was just about motivation. And I think there is a lot of that, that, you know, the reason why the people that do programming are doing programming is because at some point they found it interesting and they got motivated to do so. Because there's so many barriers to actually doing it. It's, you know, a lonely process. It's intellectually challenging with long durations without reward. So it takes a certain type of mindset that gets interested. But just after that, whether every person on, every human being has the intellectual acumen to do it, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if that's true. And that's been something I've been dancing around for a while in the thought process.
Also bear in mind that we have narrowed where a lot of technology goes, that we have this thought process of this is what a developer is, and that is reinforced through both tech culture and in academia.
Yeah.
So the fact that it is a lonely endeavor, I don't know that is intrinsic
right.
to
There's
the
pair programming, for example, that totally changes that.
Right. And yeah, there is the ability to interact with others. I've had projects before where I worked on it where there was so much collaboration where I would write a little bit and then they would write a little bit and we were just riffing off of each other, trying to figure out, you know, what the API should be and what the use cases would be. And it was a very fun coding experience and very social. But I also know there are the other times where you're just sitting alone in the dark and
yeah,
just typing away.
But so. What do you think about, I don't know. So it's interesting that we're talking about this. We have a listener, Matt McPherson, who has a whole project about learning to code. It's Edabit, EDABIT.com. And it looks like it's Learn to Code with Interactive Challenges, the fastest, easiest, most addictive way to learn. Definitely sounds like a commercial. Sorry about that. That's just the tagline of the site. I don't know if it's a profit or not. We've talked a lot about these kind of services. We've had a few of them on the show that talk about, that try to make learning how to program fun. And I have definitely engaged with people in my life and suggested that they do that, and they were not interested. So, I don't know. Do you think that everybody, do you think that the reason why we're, it's such a select people that are actually doing programming is because of the way the systems currently are set up? Or do you think it's inherently about thinking about abstract logic?
Personally, I think that while not everyone can program, just because I think there are a lot of people who have problems with spelling, there are a lot of people who have problems with basic math. So obviously there are going to be some people who can't deal with logical flow.
Okay.
But I think that that is a relatively small portion of the population.
Mm-hmm.
Now the question is,
like what, 50%?
No, much lower. I would say less than 10%.
Hmm.
That couldn't handle it for some cognitive deficit.
Mm-hmm.
I think of times where humanity at large was largely illiterate, and there was no need to be literate per se in that society.
And if you were alive then, you would say that only a small cadre of people actually could ever learn to read.
Sure. Not to mention the fact of, like, how would you get all the books out there? Illuminated manuscripts took forever to copy and disseminate. If you have a society that does not prioritize or value the notions of an algorithm or of mathematics with multiple variables, then you have a society that doesn't require it.
And by definition, it is an abstract idea or a non-important idea if most people are not aware of it, like in the sense that it doesn't have relevance to your life.
Right. And that's true of anything. But if our society, you have to be literate. And everywhere you look, there is a sign that you need to read. There is something
so
that you need to interact with.
So I guess the question is computer programming something that's going to be akin to literacy at some point in our future?
I don't know that, especially because we have more and more things being done for us by computers. So that's an open question. If For example, I think of the tax system. I remember when I first took calculus and I was learning how to do integrals and was thinking, oh, wow, you could write an integral and that would determine your tax burden. You'd figure out a curve and then there wasn't a, you know, let me look at a tax table. Mm-hmm. It was just you enter your number, you do the equation, and you get out the output. And it was always a graded scale. You never had...
You wouldn't have slots in the columns, yeah.
And...
That's how it should work, of course.
But it can't. Because one of the things about laws and one of the things about systems is that people have to understand them to accept them. Well, it's one of the same problems with complex voting systems. There are types of voting systems that are more complex.
I totally agree with you that laws do have to be understood by people. But of course, we actually have whole languages of law. That's what a law degree is understand the languages of law. So you have to be trained to understand that language. And what is computer programming but another training of computer language or of languages? So additionally, what we're currently doing in society is we're codifying and we're putting into code the practices of the implementations of our laws. So for example, what kind of name you can have on your driver's license mm-hmm. has been written by a person. And it no longer matters what the law is because the implementation in mass is that piece of code. And so that has become default law, if you will. The program itself.
In this case, the program that accepts what a name is.
Yes. Another aspect of this is, you know, what are the boundaries of the areas of where people can vote and who their representatives? Mm-hmm. Those are all defined by maps and people and organizations. But then they get put into a system, and that system is codified by somebody, and that system tells the truth of what my address correlates to. That's a code that does that. That's a program that does that. And more our society is actually governed by software engineers that or software developers that are codifying what we agreed upon as law into a program, which is now the de facto standard of truth. This is a concept of Warren Sachs, my friend Warren, who's a professor of computer science and art at UCSC.
Yes, but I think of one particular area of law, like, say, gerrymandering. We've covered this on the show before, where a math professor was talking about how to just look at populations for different states and geometrically figure out the optimum distribution and ordering of a state so that the populations were equal, it was fair, it followed geography well, you know, that type of thing. And then I think of gerrymandering as it exists in, for example, North Carolina, one of the more egregious examples. They used computers and algorithms for that to figure out how to sway elections to their benefit and best, the opposite of what you might consider fair.
Sure.
So,
but,
and the thing is, if you had it just by geometric, if you have a notion of a society saying we embrace algorithms, we embrace the math of it, you'd end up with something that was more fair.
No. Why would you say that?
I think that actually would be true.
But you just said that North Carolina, they're using the computer algorithms to find out exactly how to position the district to have the best advantage. That's not fair at all, but they're using code. And
they
algorithms.
Are, but they're doing it in such a way that they are not trying to democratize that data.
Sure.
Their method only works if you have a population that does not fully engaged with the process.
Okay, but the democracy aspect aside, what's actually happening from the perspective of writing programs that control the population or manage things, that the step of doing that is an elite process in the sense that there's only 25,000 people a year that have computer science concepts coming into our population. And it is doing complicated steps and then solidifying that into a code. That process of what we were talking about, whether it's going to be noble or not, I think has to do with who implements it.
I don't mean nobility. I mean in terms I'm not speaking correctly about that. Okay. I think I did misspeak because I was trying to bring home the point of you can use algorithms in order to entrench and mm-hmm. isolate yourself mm-hmm. in much the same way as illuminated manuscripts versus a printing press. You can try to extend it out so that everyone understands what you're talking about, or you can try to make it more of a isolated tower mentality.
So let me ask you this about computer programming and how we're thinking about it right now, how I kind of in my current process, I'm not sure how many people can actually learn to program. You could also think of like someone that created Illuminated Manuscript, someone that actually created books and by handwriting, laboriously writing. And then you say to them, will the entire population learn to read? Will the entire population learn to write? And the person that's sitting there writing, it's like, there's no way everybody's going to write because this takes years of practice and all this energy and stuff. Yeah. But then, of course, all of us now write all the time.
Yeah, you fast forward to the printing press and then to Pulp Fiction, and all of a sudden you've got stuff that the manuscript writers would not even think of it as literature out there everywhere.
But you'd also, the whole process of copying was a big part of that skill, right? The ability to actually write. I don't actually have the ability to write legibly quickly or even very well. But of course, I type 100 words a minute, no problem. So, well, I mean, a little slower than that.
So the analogy here would be somebody who uses Excel or somebody who uses Automator or maybe Photoshop Actions. These people are programming, but they don't consider themselves doing it.
Sure.
In fact, you were talking about who is able to do it and who isn't. I would say you can tell the first time somebody's using a computer whether they are intimidated by it and whether they shut down when things don't work or whether they continue to press through and try to figure out, well, that didn't work. What if I do this other thing? Or what if I keep clicking? Those people have the fundamental skill to eventually program should they choose to keep going that direction, which is to persist through the thing not working.
Well, there's... That comes into the play of, I actually believe algorithmic thought also comes into place with things like art and music. That notion of one step and the next step. A lot of simple steps that lead to a wonderful whole. And when you think of it that way, there are a lot of people that say, oh, well, I started to, you know, tinker on the piano and I don't know what I'm doing. It sounds horrible and I'm going to stop. So I don't know that it necessarily has to do with a person's innate ability. I think there may be a personality trait that says, I'm going to stop. It may be an experience they had that made them. There are a lot of times where we recoil from an experience because we don't want to feel stupid. Mm-hmm. If we can tell ourselves that it is not something for everyone or not worthwhile in some way, it saves our own self-image from perceiving ourselves as less. Mm-hmm. It's when you get past that and just go, the computer is not an adversary.
Yeah, but
when the piano
that
is not
experience
an adversary.
Of some people feeling like, well, let's be dismissive of this because it's not important and only some people can do this, and they let go of it. That is part of the process of learning to program or not, right? That is a deciding factor in whether you're going to be a programmer or not.
But I think that's all knowledge. It's not just programming.
I agree. I'm also... The reason I bring it up has to do with this idea that, you know, at one point in the world, the people that wrote down, wrote things down, codified the law of the land, right? That's what writing was, in a large part, was the rule set, whether it be religious or legal from...
Well, accounting more likely, but yeah.
And then accounting as well. But the actual creating of those things was the way that we defined what truth was. And we now are doing that in code more than anything else. Right, who your friends are is defined by Facebook's code. This, of course, is flippant as well, but it does touch upon a lot of things, like whether your car is registered or not. And that's happening more and more. So there is this kind of inherent power structure that exists in our society right now that's growing all the time, and the people that are implementing that power differential are computer software engineers. Just how the society is working and how it's going. And so the more you get people understanding that process and the more you educate people and actually maybe teach them how to program, the more they have control over their own world. Wikipedia did something interesting?
Wikipedia, a little while back, converted to HTTPS, in other words, secure channel. You can't eavesdrop on what you're looking at. Right now, and this was always an issue because foreign governments would actually track to see where people were looking, to see... Are they looking up articles that are unfavorable to the party line, you know, or are they looking at something that would be potentially embarrassing? Tiananmen Square massacre, for example, in China is an example of such an article. And
So when we think of HTTPS, we often think about securing our passwords and our financial information when we're talking to the bank.
When we're sending credit card number information.
Right. But now the security involved in going over a locked channel, HTTPS channel, mm-hmm. is that people are not able to see what you're looking at.
Exactly. And we've been finding, or what some Harvard researchers were found, was that there were fewer instances of censorship, state-sponsored censorship of Wikipedia after they started encrypting all the traffic, because they couldn't see exactly what people were looking at. Awesome. You were a little bit behind the curve in figuring out whether something was a problem, whereas before you could just put a tap on the line, look at all the keywords going through.
Because what's really interesting about the HTTP protocol is that when you connect to a server, that's actually known if DNS is non-secure. So they know that the government's going to know that you're visiting Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. But the actual request for a link, even though normally it looks like the domain name and the link are all in the same URL space, the truth is you connect to the server and you ask after you've connected, can I get this resource? And that is actually part of the HTTPS tunnel, so there's no way to know what that resource was.
So the full URL is hidden. It's only the domain that somebody's going to be able to
only get the name lookup,
Yeah. And, of course, the domain thing really is you ask for Wikipedia.com, and it resolves to an IP address, and you get that IP address. So it's also possible that, for example, one IP address can have multiple domains on it. And even that, you wouldn't necessarily know which domain you were asking for.
Or in the case of Wikipedia, you may not know which language the person is looking at, whether they're looking at EN English or ES Spanish or RU Russian.
Or onward and onward and onward, lots of languages. Oh, cool. So they've done that and have fought government censorship because of it.
Well, they've always been against government censorship. I mean, that's one of the things about Wikipedia. Like, the sole purpose is to collate, aggregate, and put together information. So anything that goes contrary to that goal, like denying people access to that information, is obviously going to be contrary to the goal of the site itself. The question is, if you put it on HTTPS, where a government can no longer see what is going back and forth, all they know is they're looking at Wikipedia or a site like it, the choice becomes for that government, do I cut off all access completely, or do I let all of it through? You can't cherry pick anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And then you run into that problem of what is the loss? Because Wikipedia is now very well known.
Yeah.
So your citizens are going to notice, far more than just an article isn't available. Notice that the entire site isn't available, and going to try to find ways to circumvent that.
Yeah. And the choice between shutting down the entire site and not being able to cherry pick those few things that you want to censor. China's the one that really sticks out there. They try to please their population enough that nobody gets annoyed enough to get up in arms about this. So if they shut down all of Wikipedia, that would be noticed.
Well, that would be a Western view of it, but sure.
Okay, yeah.
What's the perspective of that?
I'll put my hand up there. Definitely Western view here.
All right, thank you for that story. Brian, you wanted to bring us back to programming a little bit and tell us about Vim.
It's been a while since we talked about Vim and Emacs, but going back a while ways, we had a discussion about how opaque both of those can be. Well, it turns out that on Stack Overflow, there has been a question asked many years ago about how do I get out of Vim?
How do you just exit the program?
How do you just exit this? I got into the editor, but I don't know how to get out.
Right.
On a Mac or any Linux derivative, if you write the letters VI in terminal and then hit enter, you enter into a new, you run an application, which is actually kind of hard to exit if you don't know how to exit it.
Yeah, and if you have never used Vim before, you're probably going, wait, how do I exit out of a program? What do you mean?
It's command line, so it's part of the term.
And anyone who has actually used VI has said like, oh yeah, I remember that.
I do remember the experience of not knowing how to get out. That's true.
Yeah, I just always put it in the background and kill the thing.
I had friends in college that they went in to any. It could be a mail program, it could be VI or anything. They went in, they started, writing what they needed to do, and then when they were done, after, for example, a mail program usually was saved ahead of time or sent, they would Control Z, which is put into the background, and then they'd log out.
And that would kill it.
You know? That would kill it.
So VI specifically, the way you exit it, there's two different modes. You can be insertion mode or non-insertion mode. Just
push insert mode and escape mode.
Yeah. So you can push escape a few times, and that will get you to a space where you can now push colon and then Q. And if you really want to quit without saving, and in case you've started editing and stuff, you can do the bang character. That's the exclamation point. So those character sets, escape, colon, Q, bang, will exit Vim every time.
Or colon, WQ, write, and
if
quit.
If you want to write, sure, sure.
Or without the colon, capital ZZ.
What is capital ZZ?
That's right, save and exit. It.
Really?
Yep.
Didn't know that. Awesome.
You know what's funny? I've been trying to think.
What if you
want to
type capital ZZ?
What?
What if you want to type ZZ?
Well, then you're in insert mode.
Okay.
When you're in escape mode, sure. You just type capital Z, and you're out and saved.
What's funny to me about this is I've been trying to remember all day how I get out of Vim, and I don't know. My brain does not know. I know my fingers know. I have the muscle memory. Awesome. If I'm there, I will be able to get out. So on May 23rd, we hit the mark where Stack Overflow had 1 million questions or 1 million lookups to this question. That means 1 million people in the last 5 years have been trying to get the answer to this question. And they did a whole write-up awesome. On what they could tell from the people that have been visiting. And I think this is pretty obvious, but who do you think, what kind of developer profession or developer role would you say are the ones looking up this question most?
Probably a web developer.
Front-end web developer.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. People that generally use... they're able to determine that these people are generally using IDEs and are generally not using straight text editor to do all their
editing. And nowadays, you're spinning up a whole runner that is actually doing all this stuff for you, including spinning up a box. So you're actually never really at the terminal in your editing modes normally. But if you're using Git, you've got to know how to use Vim. I mean, it's... anyway.
No, you don't. Wait, clients. No, you don't.
Lots of judgment here.
No, you don't.
Hey, this wait, hold Geek on. Geek Speakers Registered Service Mark David Lawrence, who's used with permission to Geek Speak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know we sent you. The theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, and I want to thank him and also Greg Merkley for giving us the title One Login Collapses Playground Exit. It is the beginning of the month of June, and therefore I want to thank our patrons, Chris Irwin, Pat Hader, Jerry Devine, Jim Warner, Glenn Nelson, Luke Pigeon, John Winston, Dave Holloway, David Leap, Alexis Chen, Narajis Clenius, and Tim Ramsey. Also 20 other people that are not going to be named, but I appreciate all of you. If you'd like to participate in helping out our program, you can do so by spreading the word, letting other people know that might like the program, giving us ratings on different things, and also if you'd like to give some money, you're welcome to do that. Go to geekspeak.org/support. Hey, we're doing a live show in Ben Lomond, California on June 19th. I'd love you to join me and Miles and Brian and a whole bunch of other cool people. Go ahead and learn more information and get your free ticket at live.geekspeak.org. What? Go ahead.
With Git, you can set up what your default editor is.
I know, but who would change it away from Vim? Vim is awesome.
Nano.
You use Nano, seriously?
No, I don't.
No, of course not.
No,
use Vim.
No, hold on. The only reason that I use Vim is because I learned it in college, and because I now know it, I will use it. If I had learned Nano when I was Pico or Nano, when I was in college, and that was the one that I was encouraged to use, there'd be no way that I would think, you know what? I think I'm going to learn this new VI thing.
Wait, so what is so good about Nano?
Or old VI thing.
What is so good about Nano?
It's just simplified, and yeah, it doesn't have these multiple modes.
When I was learning VI, I really did have to do HJKL in order to move around, to go up, dude, down, left, right.
Dude, you can't even navigate in this app. I'm doing J and K, and I'm not moving around.
You're typing a lot of letters, aren't you?
Yeah, it's really irritating. It just keeps on typing.
So, curse is based, and it has, at the bottom, all of your commands.
Haven't you seen that?
You know what a caret is.
Yeah, like, you've done cron, right? Because cron often comes up with Nano.
Cron?
Cron will come up if you're doing, like, a cron tab.
Yeah.
Oh, does it
cron
use
tab?
That will come up with whatever editor you have configured.
The default environments seem to be Nano these days.
Really?
Okay.
How do I don't want to exit. Ugh. Yeah. God, I felt dirty using that.
Now, from a programmer standpoint, VI is extremely powerful. And
yeah,
if you,
but you don't use it that
especially way. If you're not using a mouse along with it, if you're just using keystrokes, and you learn how
can't
to use
it.
Use
a mouse with Vim? With VI?
Actually,
it's been extended a lot.
Yeah, you can. But but at the same time, it's still something that that was born before there was a mouse and a full environment. And there are many people who like it. Many people like that they never have to take their hand from the home position on the keyboard. Had I been given a choice, I don't know that I would have bothered.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you have a choice every day about learning Emacs, and some people swear by it, but you've never learned Emacs. We just don't do it. I've been using IntelliJ for my IDE at work for my Groovy development, and it is just this hog. It keeps on taking on my resources. It spins up the processor at 300%.
Which is a shame, because IntelliJ used to be known as the very slim, lightweight IDE.
I know a lot of people that have no problems with it, so I don't know what's going on with my machine. It's probably this friggin' second processor for my keyboard that kills me.
For the touchpad.
I literally the other day was texting, writing something, and I kept on, all my characters were getting in reversed in order. You know, the start with an H, and I'd back it up and do it again. I'm like, I must be typing too fast. And then I watched myself and watched that I did it in order, and the keyboard was doing it incorrectly. That's how...
I've seen this in macOS, but it's been years.
Oh, God, it's so frustrating.
I only ever noticed that on my phone in Facebook. Because Facebook, they have re-engineered the text box. It's not the system one.
Sure.
And so I'll be like trying to type. And, you know, you're on an iPhone, which means that you shouldn't be typing all that fast anyway. But apparently, I type fast enough that it goofs and has letters out of order. Like,
I can't tell you how horrible it is to have your keyboard not do what you're trying to do. It's like this, well, this whole computer's broken. I'm going to throw this away. I could get on Siri and have it dictate it for me. But the IDE's been really irritating, so I finally went back to Sublime, and now I'm doing all my writing in Groovy in Sublime, and then when I need to look up some obscure Netflix reference to some library that
obscure?
I'm not... Obscure? Did I say obscure?
Obscure?
Obscure.
It's an O there.
You're such a pedant, dude. IDE.
There were literally three times during the regular broadcast that I wanted to call it out, and I'm like, no, don't interrupt his flow. We're trying to get this in one take. He doesn't have to do a whole bunch of editing.
By the way, there's not a lot of editing except for freaking Brian sneezing.
Hey, at least you got him marked.
I do have him marked. And actually marking it is going to speed me up a lot, too. But I have to get the show in the can. I've got to put it on air tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.
So when do you hand it over to them?
I upload it tonight. It's this really great web application.
Such a bad app. Oh, God.
Oh, so bad.
Okay, are you saying you want to finish this up?
No, I want to keep talking to you guys about cool things. I don't want to edit. I hate editing.
Okay, so next story, quick thing.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
So IBM Watson won Jeopardy. That's
yes.
How everyone came to know it.
Yes,
and
natural
so IBM
language.
Moved to medicine. So apparently Watson has gotten to the point that it's about as good at diagnosing cancer as experts are.
With what inputs?
So looking at...
a doctor reads what they wrote to it.
looking at the same data. So whether you were looking at a film transfer.
You can just look at a film transfer and it can just...
Actually, I don't know if it's a film transfer. Let's see. Learned lab reports, doctor notes, x-ray reports, research papers.
Holy crap. Really?
PSA
and
levels.
And so it does not do better than the human being as yet.
Yeah, but that's...
But it does agree with the human doctor, with an expert, from about 73% to 96%. So it ends up being, in this case, not a replacement for the doctor, but rather an immediate second opinion.
Would you like a second opinion?
Exactly. Yeah, it's a sanity check, as it were.
Yeah, but can't it also do? God, we need to collect better data about medical information.
Well, no, we just need to structure that data in a useful way. So, isn't that the holy grail?
I just realized, like, you can't give it good input because you don't have the good input. Like,
no.
Which drugs counteract with other drugs? No one really knows.
No, the data of medicine is largely based on a story.
Yeah, Brian, you've got another story about CPUs.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm not a big CPU guy, but I thought it was interesting that the CPU wars are heating up in the sense that both AMD and Intel are coming out with chips that are pushing some limits.
14 nanos now?
Oh, you know, I didn't even see what the process was, but a few weeks ago, AMD announced its high-end desktop platform, which has both 16 and 32 thread
cores.
It's talking threads here, but oh, okay. Yeah.
That's the AMD one, yeah.
That's the AMD one. So Intel turned around and is coming out with the new X line of processors that it's some of them are the low end is just an update to Kaby Lake, mm-hmm. With a few other features put in there, but it goes all the way up to a 999 10 core unit called the they're now calling that the i9 processor.
That was the former flagship, wasn't it?
That was the former flagship, was at that level, and I think it used to be at what, $1,300 for that?
No, the blue is closer to $1,800.
Yeah. $1,800. So that's dropped down to $999. And then the king of all of them, which is a 32-core.
I'm trying to 18 core.
18 core, yeah. Is maxing out close to $2,000 again.
So with hyper-threading, you double that. And
there's all sorts of features in there. And they're getting up to 140 watts of power. And we're talking about something in the range of 4.4 megahertz or gigahertz, sorry. So even in the single core speed, it's going to beat AMD at its game. So what I've been trying to figure out is who is going to be able to use these processors. The one thing I keep seeing written about is that people who play video games and like to broadcast it on Twitch are...
Oh, no. This is for server farms.
So you can virtualize a million operating systems on there, but
right. This is not gamers.
And yet,
this is not for them.
And that's what Ars Technica is talking about here, is that it's those Twitch gamers that are going to be getting the most use out of this.
Well, from an everyday person perspective, but of course, all of us use Amazon Cloud, right? So these machines are going to be there. And also VR stuff. I mean, it's mostly the graphics card, I guess.
The server motherboards would have, you know, 4 or 6 of these processors.
By the way,
so how many cores you have on a single?
By the way, Skylake and Kaby Lake are 14 nanometers now. God, when we started GeekSpeak, 65 nanometers was amazing. It's 14 now.
Wait, it was 65 when we started? Really? I thought it was more than that.
It might be more. I just remember 65 being a big thing. It was like a big deal.
So it was 100 megahertz.
No, not when we started.
I'm trying to think back. 60. Okay, you're right. We were getting 500 megahertz then, right?
In 2006, the Core Solo was 65 nanometers. The Core Duo was 65 nanometers.
Okay, so when we started, it was noticeably larger.
Before that, yeah, that was just when we started talking about the processors at more level. The thing about 14 nanometers is that you're getting really small. Like, that's tens of atoms. That's not anything to shake a fist at. Like, that's really small.
Which might have something to
shake a little tiny fist at.
Like
a Trump fist.
Ouch.
Post show, we get political. I can't believe he made a nanometer joke about his fist. You win. I was trying to think of the word Trump, but I block it from my vocabulary so much I couldn't say it fast enough. What were you saying, Brian?
Oh, my joke is lost.
Okay. The interview I did recently, they were talking about that we talk about social stuff a lot. And why do we talk about social stuff so much on GeekSpeak? And I kind of brought up, like, you know, it's fun to geek out about how many nanometers the traces are on a chip. But when it comes down to whether that affects the world or how transient that is, that's, you know, these nanometer counts are really transient. They change all the time.
They change all the time, but they are still important.
They're important. There's nothing about important, but when it comes down to like how fast the USB connector works versus the new connector, and you know, is Thunderbolt better, and that stuff is time based, right?
Sure.
It's very about the moment, and how our society changes over time and how we cope with it in education. Those are much broader and last longer as an impact and have more effect on the human condition than if it's a 16 nanometer or 65 nanometer. The effects are great, but the social contracts seem to be more important. I mean, well, yeah, that was my guess of why we talk more about social stuff.
I mean, I think it's the real answer is because we're interested in it. But you just look at the effect the iPhone has had and all smartphones have had in the last 10 years. And societally, it's a huge effect. I mean, yeah. You can trace back to the election.
Yeah, that kills me how much we are dependent upon smartphones and what we do with them and what they're capable of. And you go past 10 years, they didn't exist. Like the most you had were those Nokia monsters or the Blackberries, the massive keyboard and a small screen.
You could play Snake on a Nokia. Don't.
And there was Palm Pilot and Handspring. Yeah, I was trying to remember Handspring.
Right, but not the same.
Oh, it was the Palm Pilot split off. Yeah. And I had the cell phone module, and I had. Anyways, it was like a smartphone before it was smart enough. All of this has been within 10 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's affecting us because social media. Yeah, there was social media before the phone, but social media has become its own social impact because of the phone.
Right. And folks who are 10 years younger than we are can barely remember when the internet didn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just 10 years younger than we are.
Wow. That's trippy.
Because, I mean, I got onto the internet when I started college.
Yeah.
So I was 18 years old.
Yeah.
And an 8-year-old isn't going to know one way or another.
Wow. When I first saw the web and, like, you know, Navigator, the second thing they did is showed me the source code, and then we played with it. It's like I was introduced.
Oh, the source code to the website.
Yeah.
Not to the browser.
No, to the website. So the first thing I saw about the web is how it's created. It was the same time. It wasn't like a different day. And then he showed me buttons, form submission, you know, how that stuff worked. Yeah, kind of showed me a bit about that, and I launched from there. So anyway.
It's been kind of it's funny. I remember the first time I ever saw a web browser. And it was on the X Windows system on someone's computer when they were connecting up to the university network. And he was doing it off of a 9600 baud modem. Mm-hmm. And he shows you, like, look, and it loads an image. And I have to be honest, like, I'm sorry, Jeff. I looked at it and it was just like, so?
No, I was excited about it right away. And I remember, like, right after that, talking to the company I was working for and, like, you have to get a website. Yeah. And like, what? I'm like, yeah, you got to get domain name.
Bear in mind, this was also before Netscape. This was Spry Mosaic.
Yeah, no, I saw it first with Netscape, so it was already kind of exciting.
Parents have no right to a dead child's Facebook account. Coming down from a German court. So their daughter was hit by a train, and it wasn't clear whether or not she killed herself or whether it was an accident. And one of the things they wanted to do was look into the Facebook account, which had been locked down, memorialized, so now it's just a message board for people to say their condolences and remembrances. But they wanted to be able to look into the account and see, could they see any signs of she was talking about depression, or did she talk about, you know, like any clues? But the German court, and you have to bear in mind the historical context to Germany, which is knowledge of the East German Stasi and that surveillance culture that existed for many decades, that privacy is sacrosanct.
Right. And even right to be forgotten is sacrosanct.
Right. And so if they're going to err, they're going to err on the side of privacy, not as the U.S. does, which is like privacy, unless it's really inconvenient, according to the FCC. Anyway, and their reason for this was they were saying, we don't know, we can't just, this is compelling, but if we make this ruling, that means that parents in general will be able to petition to get their children, or, you know, someone will be able to get a family member's access to it. And not everyone would want to have access. Like, if you mm-hmm. want to give access to a family member, you need to tell them that information to get into the account ahead of time.
Now, you're specifically talking about adult children, right?
Sure. Yeah, although, depending upon the area, who knows what the laws are, and the legal age of consent is different in different countries.
That's true. It's interesting. I was thinking the entire time it was a non-adult child. Right. But you're right. It might be an adult child.
You did say it was an 18-year-old child. Yeah, I don't know what the laws in and practice in Germany.
18-year-old's an adult in Germany. So I still haven't, we haven't memorialized my grandmother's site. Mm-hmm. She passed away in December, I believe. And we still haven't memorialized hers. Maybe it was January. I can't remember now. Because it actually reduces what you can do with the content. Like once you memorialize it, you can't do certain things.
Right.
But we have her password, so it's not memorialized because we have control. I know that's a breach of contract from Facebook, and I'm just saying, I don't care.
right. But it did get me to thinking, like, what are those things? No one else knows the password to get access to my laptop. No one knows my... No.
Why haven't we done that?
Because I haven't thought about it. Ah. You know, a lot of times you don't think about your own mortality with regard to
I have a piece of paper hidden where Maggie knows where it is. And on that piece of paper is a couple master passwords and instructions to talk to Miles. Which looks really funny.
Really?
Because I figured you'd be able to figure things out. As long as you have the password, you'll be able to figure it out.
And I know where all the bodies are buried anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
And she'll be in grief, honestly.
Yeah. But the other thing, of course, is my Gmail system, which has a lot of capabilities because, of course, a lot of accounts you can reset with your email. And so whoever has access to my email has access to a lot of things. And that actually has a termination thing that if I don't use the service and log into it for 4 months, it'll assume I'm dead and email the information to ability for download and full access to both my wife and my sister.
When did Google add that?
Google has it. It's been added there for a long time.
I can't remember what they call it now, but it's not the app Google Apps version. That's just a regular Gmail account.
This is just all the data in your Gmail on your Google account. So right now, Google has this great ability for you to download all your data. And you can just download this giant file that's everything. And you can choose what's in it. So all your location information. And there, I guess, was an engineer's like pet project to make sure it's available for people. And in that area, you can say what happens if you're not you don't access
it. Oh, so it's not giving you access. It's just sending you the data.
I think it gives them the ability to download all the data. And access all the data, yeah. So I guess
it's called Google Takeout, I believe.
That part's not, but anyway, we'll have to look it up.
Something that it's not necessarily comfortable.
You don't have set that up yet.
I haven't. I've been negligent about it.
But the password thing is really challenging. So, for example, my 1Password file, which has all my passwords in it, is in my Dropbox, but no one knows my password to my Dropbox, including me. Only my 1Password system knows what my password is for my Dropbox. So there's kind of a catch-22 there, right? It holds the archive, and to get to the service, you have to know the password that's in the archive. So the way this is solved in my life is that I have multiple devices that have that thing on it already and are syncing. So, but those devices are all now controlled by the company I work for, Netflix, right? So the password for my laptop is actually a password that I haven't shared with my wife because it's a laptop that's work's laptop. And my phone is completely locked down because it's one of those corporate account things so that Netflix can erase it remotely if necessary. So right now, if I, get hit by a bus or train, I guess it was a train, then somebody at Netflix would have to work with my wife and maybe you, Miles, to get access to the data that I've got. I don't know. I guess it's something we should all be thinking about. What about you, Brian? What are you doing with your passwords?
I gave a really good friend who doesn't live near here half of my password.
And with the other half?
And my wife.
Yeah, that's cool. So wait, half, really? So they didn't give the full password to your wife?
That's a long story. Yeah, she's got it by now, but I'm not sure she knows which one it is.
Right, right. Well, that's the tricky part, is that if you change it or it's a few different options. And yeah.
Yeah, but no, it's definitely not foolproof.
Yeah, I think of if I died and couldn't get access to my laptop.
If you die, you definitely can't get access to your laptop.
No, like
someone else.
Yeah, someone else can't get. I just think of things like, well, what will be lost? Well, happily, the code I've been writing, I recently checked into GitHub, so
okay,
you got access to that.
I see your priorities here.
But without having that access, it means that all the photos that I have collected on the smartphone and a few from the Nokia 6230 that I had before then, just you wouldn't be able to get access to. Like, they exist on the time capsule as well, but
is the hard drive encrypted?
It is not.
I can get access to it.
Okay.
No problem.
That is true.
So I download and back up all my photos. There's copies scanning all the time to Google. So my sister and wife, after a certain period of time, will have access to those photos. Those aren't the raw, though. The raw are on the hard drive, and that's not encrypted. So there's a there's two portable hard drives that have copies. So that's how I've solved that.
I can't think of anything else that is really that sensitive. I mean,
I also don't know how important all this is.
If you have a death certificate, you can go to a bank and you can get that information.
Exactly. How important is all this stuff really when it comes down to it? When we're gone, does it really matter? You can't get access to my email or my Dropbox account?
No, but like all data, it's not, most of it's unimportant, but you don't know which part somebody's going to find really important someday.
We're going to have way too much data. I mean,
but isn't that what all these AI tools are supposed to give us, is finally able to tame our massive photo libraries and our massive unstructured data?
So for the last 8.5 years, I've been managing this property that I'm leaving. And one of the tasks to do every month is take meter readings of all electrical meters, because it's shared resources on the property. And I take photos for years. I've been taking photos of these meters every month. And then I painstakingly read the meter reading. It's actually kind of hard to read. And just today I was thinking, God, that'd be cool, like time lapse to see the meters go. You know, I could actually have all these photos that are aligned. There's no way I want to do that by hand, but it'd be cool if an AI just did that for me. Like something just was like, here's this meter going, you know, month by month for 8 years. Isn't that neat, right? But the truth is, I don't know if we'll ever get a situation that would happen automatically. Why would anybody code that? Do you see what I'm saying?
But the AI will code itself.
I was just thinking, we all have parents and grandparents, you know,
as
they get older.
That's how it works,
Miles. There's a garage that's full of stuff, and they pass on, and you're like, I don't know what this is. We all have that relative that's a hoarder that you're just like, please just get rid of that. I don't know. Why do they have an empty Coke can? Why is, you know? And to a large extent, I find that I don't have that much stuff in terms of physical things, although I'm not elderly as yet. Thankfully, I don't suffer from dementia that I'm aware of. But my laptop is such a pack rat delight. Like, it's
digital storage.
Huh? Yeah, it's so unorganized, and I happen to know where this is, and I have projects in this folder, but also in this folder and this one. Yeah.
So when you hit the limit of your drive, which I know is pretty big now, do you have another drive somewhere else where you have your not immediately accessed stuff, or do you just keep it all on there?
I mean, I have a time capsule, so there's a copy of everything.
Right, right. So you have one setup that has everything that you can...
Basically.
Yeah. Because I constantly don't.
I mean, I have a little bit of code on like some Raspberry Pis, but...
I totally envy you, Miles. There's no way... There's not one system that can have all the data I've produced.
And it's a constant battle of what am I going to pull off of here? What I might want for some reason...
This week, you know, we're recording late, because in this whole week I've been thinking, what am I going to do? What am I going to do? I got to get a show out. And the entire week I'm like, well, I can go and do the Waz show, because the Waz show is always fun to throw up. He's an interesting guy, and what the heck. And but then I got to go get the Waz show. Where's the files? And I'm thinking, oh, it's on that NAS thing, you know? I'm like, ugh.
So wait, nah. Recording this 2-hour show is easier than finding your NAS.
This is much more enjoyable.
Yeah, I'm not a video maven. I don't do a whole lot of audio recording. I mean, I guess I have a bunch of music on there, but it's
the largest thing. It's not unique music.
The largest things that I have on there are probably the global information system, like the OpenStreetMap data.
Which is public data anyway.
And it is, but it's also, I regularly delete it and start with smaller subsets just because it's too big. If I had a larger hard drive, I probably would download the entire planet.
What do you guys do for your music? Do you pay for music services, Pandora or anything?
I used to pay for Pandora. I don't anymore.
I've never been a big music person. I have a giant library that I collected around 2000. It was around 2000.
I have that too, and it's on my NAS. It's not on.
Yeah, I used to, you know, buy CDs and collect CDs, so I ripped all of those CDs back in the day onto iTunes, so I have a huge music library now.
On that one computer?
Yeah.
So I recently paid for Google Play Music, which also gives you YouTube Red for the family. It's like $12 a month, and all of us have any music we want and no commercials on YouTube. I highly recommend it. Wyatt was just, my son was just going, Dad, it's so great not to have commercials. I'm like, yes, it is. Of course, that's why I work at Netflix. of course, it's true. It's a different impact when you're watching YouTube with the commercials for some time.
See, I like the ads actually on YouTube because they serve as a...
Do you like the Hulu ones as well?
Because they serve as a sufficient...
barrier?
Annoyance, I was going to say.
It's like Vim for my video watching.
No, a sufficient annoyance for my daughter that she'll be annoyed and just get angry whenever it comes up and interrupts her listening to Moana or whatever.
Does she switch over to Netflix when that happens?
She'll get distracted and go do something else while she's waiting for the ad to end.
And then I'm shut the computer down?
Yeah, and I'm done.
Yeah, my children are lost. I had the same thought as you just said, but they just watched through the commercial. And they're grumbling about it the whole way, but they watch it.
So all you have to do is pay $12 a month and they can watch more TV.
No.
Now, speaking of TV and media and stuff like that, it turns out that we can now convert, we have the technology to convert every film and TV show from the last 80 years from standard definition to high definition.
Why for the last 80 years? How?
Because...
Is it a translation or...
You know, listening to this show... Or being a part of it, you remember that there was technology to be able to take blurred images or low resolution images and then find the actual derive the text from it.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
derive higher resolution photos from that.
Yeah,
the logical consequence to that technology is being able to analyze video and see over multiple frames like how it's supposed to look, where the actual borders are, and upscaling.
Okay, yeah. Because
you have multiple frames.
Yeah. We covered this at some point last year where there was a doubling of the resolution that could be done through these techniques. And that was on a static frame. Mm-hmm. But you're talking about moving frames where you can pull out even more information.
Right. And so they're actually finding that, yeah, you can make it so that it is indistinguishable from HD.
Hmm. Okay.
Or largely enough indistinguishable.
I remember years ago I was having an argument with a person that was talking about how we'll be able to generate 3D, fully 3D scenes from just old films from the 30s.
I believe it.
And at the time I was like, no, because this, and I was going all this logic about, you know, the data's not there, and the data's not there. And now I'm like, yeah, we'll be able to do that.
And do you know how we know the data is there?
Because we can see it.
Because we can see it and perceive it as a 3D model.
So computer will help. And it won't be perfect, but that's amazing. Hey, that's all the news stories. Congratulations, everyone.
Not bad.
Hold on,
for,
I'm getting corrected here by... not HD. Sorry, I messed up. Not HD as in high definition, HDR as in high dynamic range.
Oh, that's cool.
Hmm. Thank you for that, Greg.
Greg is telling you what it is. Yeah. No, that's cool. I would love to see more HDR. I haven't even seen these new HDR TVs, but that would be a reason to go back and rewatch a bunch of series.
The new high dynamic range TVs that have extra brightness are awesome.
Yeah, I've heard about it.
Yeah, I really like them.
Now we need HDR VR. I learned a new term, XR.
What's that?
XR, it's all the technologies encompassing AR, VR, and MR. What is MR? I forgot.
I got to say, I'm still one of those VR skeptics. Like, it's just... Not while you need goggles. It's just not.
Right. So when we finally have the breakthrough for touchscreen technology for the phone, we could have the breakthrough for the goggles where we finally have the contact lenses or the direct ocular implant.
Yeah, when that happens, sure. But for right now, it still seems too clunky. It's kind of like the very early days of automobiles.
Or like the end of this show.
Like important, important technology. Yeah. Important technology, but like it doesn't beat out a horse yet.